Hey, WHFR listeners, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Lindsay.
And we're your hosts for a new talk show here at Henry Ford Community College called HFCC's Campus Connection.
That's right. From 1 to 2 p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month, Dennis and I will cover the news, issues, and events here on the campus of HFCC and talk about how they relate to the surrounding communities.
Basically, we bring you all the news we think you want to know about our college and our station, WHFR.
We talk about the fantastic restaurant we have right here on campus.
And upcoming performances of HFCC plays and musicals.
We'll even keep you posted on the success of our various sports teams.
In fact, we fill you in on all of the campus activities open to the public, many of them absolutely free.
So when it comes to Henry Ford Community College news,
make the connection.
The HFCC Campus Connection. On 89.3 FM from 1 to 2 p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month.
That's WHFR.FM.
The station making waves.
See what I mean?
You're right. I'm really not the worst trumpet player in the world. Thanks, Dad.
Just keep practicing, son. You'll get it.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have sent children into fits of rage.
I am responsible for a child's speech impediment.
I am the reason a child can't read.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Henry Ford Community College Campus Connection, usually featured in this time slot, the second Tuesday of each month, is on hiatus. We're going to be featuring in its place some great talk shows from the internet from the last couple of weeks. That's our usual programming for the Monday Forum, too, and check that out. Always different, every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. For information about Henry Ford Community College campus events open to the public and, of course, all the students on campus, you can check out the details at hfcc.edu.
The CTO for the world's largest aerospace company, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, a slight departure from strictly space as we bring you a conversation with Ray Johnson, the Chief Technology Officer for Lockheed Martin. The company's Orion spacecraft will come up, but I'll mostly talk with Ray about the effort to encourage more people, and especially young people, to become the engineers behind projects like Orion. Bill Nye will join us from the exciting baggage claim at Los Angeles' airport, while Bruce Betts will get us rolling on a new What's Up Space trivia contest, including a cool new prize. Planetary Society Science and Technology Coordinator Emily Lakdawalla will get us underway. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
A couple of good things to talk about today. One of them quite fascinating. I really maybe an improvement on the periodic table. We'll get to that in a moment. How about this big object that's apparently bigger than a lot of people might have guessed?
Yeah, this one kind of snuck up on me because I discovered it just at reading the table of contents in a scientific peer-reviewed journal, and was a description of an interesting-sounding trans-Neptunian object named Selacia. It happens to be a binary. It has a large companion. And I looked at the article, and I was like, this thing is 1,000 kilometers across. That is big. That is as big as the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt series. And it makes it somewhere around the 10th biggest object in the Kuiper belt, give or take a few.
So not far behind Pluto.
Well, it's a little less than half the size of Pluto. It's actually somewhat more similar to the size of Charon. You know, there's several more big objects out there that don't really even have names. It's actually so common to have objects that big out there that, you know, they're kind of behind on the naming. There's other things like Orcus and Sedna and all of these rather interesting objects that people just really don't hear about because the main problem is that we don't know very much about them because they're so far away and they're so dim. But we're learning more and more with it each passing year, and it's really quite fascinating.
And more to come, no doubt.
Absolutely.
So let's turn to this periodic table, which has got to be the dream of geochemists everywhere. You were pretty happy to see it.
Well, of course, I've always been fascinated by the periodic table, and I suspect that most people listening to this show share that fascination. You know, you just look at it, you look at all the symbols, even if you have no idea what any of them mean, like I did when I was a little kid. I found all the numbers and the symbols absolutely fascinating. But the periodic table that we usually see displayed on the wall is, it's one written for chemists, and they have particular needs in terms of the information that they're looking for. Geochemists look at the world quite differently because they don't deal with covalently bonded compounds, which are the ones that you learn about in high school chemistry. They deal with minerals, which are crystals, which is quite a different way of atoms getting together. So this geochemist periodic table of elements details all kinds of information about the elements, not as the single atoms like you get that covalently bond with each other, but as ions and how they behave when they make ionic compounds. And it's absolutely fascinating to follow the trends. It's very different from the kinds of trends that you follow when you look at a chemist's periodic table of elements.
I used to have a map of the New York subway system on my wall. This reminds me a bit of that. But kudos to Bruce Railsback at the University of Georgia.
Yeah, he actually put it together a long time ago, and I just discovered it recently.
Emily, it's great fun. I think I'll try and trace my way through it when we are finished talking here. And I guess we are done. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Matt.
She is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine, Emily Lakdawalla. Up next, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Bill, it's not often we get to go on location for your segment, but here we are at LAX, LA International Airport.
Yes, eat your heart out, everybody. We're in baggage claim. Now, we just came from Boulder, Colorado, in the Comparative Climatology Conference. Now, you were there, Matt. It was the heavy hitters. It was the major leaguers of climate. So it was Jim Hansen, the guy who wrote the very earliest papers after discovering the greenhouse effect on Venus. Brian Toon, who was a doctoral student under Carl Sagan, and they did the early computer models of nuclear winter, where so much dust is thrown in the air that, or above the air, that the Earth turns cold, and this probably would kill the ancient dinosaurs, not with nuclear weapons, but with a meteoric impact. Karen Rice, the hydrologist who studies acid, the acidification of the Earth's soil, water, and air, is very compelling. And David Grinspoon, the guy from the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, is very good. And then I was the moderator. I moderated.
To say nothing of the nearly 600 very enthusiastic fans of climate.
And this, everybody, look, these are four world-class scientists who are very concerned about climate change because they have run the numbers. They have looked at this very carefully. And climate change here on Earth was discovered by studying other worlds. That's what we do at the Planetary Society. By studying Venus, people really, if I may, dialed in the greenhouse effect. By studying Mars, people realized what makes a world go cold when you strip away the atmosphere and so on. And then by studying the Earth, we've learned that these 7 billion people are changing it, adding greenhouse gases faster than ever before in history. And this is what's making a deep concern for us people.
It made for a great evening at the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt. Let's change the world.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. Now to the CTO of Lockheed Martin. Want to build a spacecraft? Better find yourself some good engineers, and that has been a growing problem in the United States, where there is a critical shortage of young people entering so-called STEM careers. That's STEM, or Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. Call it enlightened self-interest if you like, but aerospace and other companies, large and small, are taking a larger role in steering students to STEM, with some success. The very largest aerospace company, Lockheed Martin, is one of them, and Ray Johnson is its chief technology officer. Ray, it's great to be talking to you again. We had a pretty good crowd last time at the USA Science and Engineering Festival, but I'm very happy to welcome you to a much larger audience here for Planetary Radio.
Oh, thank you, Matt. Glad to be on your show.
Let's start with this. You are the Chief Technology Officer of Lockheed Martin. What is a CTO? What do you do?
Well, the Chief Technology Officer in Lockheed Martin Corporation has the responsibility broadly for technology and engineering. And so when you think about technology inside our $46 billion corporation, at any one time, we have 63,000 engineers working on over 4,000 programs. And so a broad range of technologies that encompass air, space, and a variety of other technical areas, making decisions about what to invest in, about what resources to apply in which research and development activities is part of my job, working with all the technical people across the enterprise. And on the engineering side, those 4,000 programs are developing things and they're developing products for our customers. And so we're working every day to make sure that those 4,000 programs deliver flawlessly on the promises that we've kept. And then finally, there's an area which I'll broadly call advanced concepts. And advanced concepts, we work with our customers to develop the concepts of operations for the new ideas that aren't yet out into our customers' environment.
So is it your job to float among these, keeping everybody on track or adding your own thoughts?
It is. We develop the technology and engineering strategy for the corporation. And as you can imagine, a large organization with 123,000 people like we have, I have a direct reporting chain. And so the senior technical person in each one of our four business areas reports to me. And so I'm able to plan the operations within the business areas by working with those people and with their staff. Additionally, I have a number of vice presidents who report to me who take on specific initiatives that bring technology forward. For example, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been working on it on an initiative in the area of nanotechnology. And now we have nanotechnology-enabled products that use carbon nanostructures and that use advanced composite, nano-enabled composites to develop materials that are stronger, lighter, and cheaper than the materials that they replace.
That's interesting. I may want to bring that up a little bit later if we have time for it. But I do wonder, what is it that led you to this position? What's your background?
Well, my background is engineering and engineering physics. And I always have had a love for math and science, and I've been fortunate to be able to translate that into my academic work in electrical engineering and engineering physics, and then transition that into the workplace here in Lockheed Martin and previous places that I've worked. Being the chief technology officer in the number one aerospace and defense company in the world is a fantastic position, and my work at an earlier age in science, technology, engineering, and math fields prepared me for that position.
You've already, just with this description, demonstrated why Lockheed Martin would have a very, if you want to put it this way, selfish interest, if not a more altruistic one, in encouraging more people to go into STEM-type careers. The company seems to be taking this this effort pretty seriously. I mean, that's why you guys were the biggest sponsor at the USA Science and Engineering Festival. Is that really what this is all about, trying to convince especially more young people to become hireable by Lockheed Martin?
Well, it is, Matt. It's beyond just being hireable by Lockheed Martin. You know, when you and I met, we were at the USA Science and Engineering Festival held at the Convention Center in Washington. And we are the host and founding sponsor for that event, second event of its kind. We believe that the number of people entering into science, technology, engineering, and math fields in the United States is declining. We're not having as many people graduate in engineering. We also know that the STEM-related fields and the associated innovations that come from that have been key to the economic prosperity and growth for the United States for the last 50 or 60 years. Globalization, the distribution of higher education, and general technology leveling across the world has made competition more severe. People talk about the decline of the United States. It's not really the decline of the United States. It's really the rise of other nations in the world. Hmm. So for our competitiveness, both as a nation and as a leader in the aerospace and defense field, we know that STEM-educated people are key to that successful workforce that we have.
Even for a company the size of Lockheed Martin, this seems like a little bit too big of a challenge to take on by yourself. What is the role that everybody should be playing in encouraging people to adopt STEM professions?
We have the great opportunity of working on technologies that are very cool, very interesting to young people. If you think about space technology, aircraft technology like the F-22 and F-35, even things like renewable energy and taking on some of the world's global problems that we face today. Those are very cool technologies. They're very interesting. And so that creates for us a wonderful bully pulpit to speak from. So we're able to really, through the exhibits that you saw, there were over 3,000 exhibits at the convention center, and they were typically hands-on exhibits. And so part of what we're doing through the Science Festival and things like that is to translate what it means to be a STEM professional, what it means to be an engineer, from the theory into the practice. When young adults or kids experience the thrill that they get in building things. Engineers create things. Engineers build. Engineers take ideas and make them reality. When they experience that and they realize that, yes, there's hard math and there are things to learn, but after we learn those, we use those skills to help us build things. That thrill of victory is an experience when you build things, when you solve problems. That's a real experience. And again, that hands-on that the Science Festival brought begins to let people know what that feels like. We're using the bully pulpit. We're not alone in this. We're working with other people in our industry and outside of our industry to really raise the awareness. And I think the way that our partner in the Science Festival, Larry Bach, describes it is we're raising science and engineering to the level of celebrity. In this nation and around the world, we celebrate movie stars, actresses, actors, sports celebrities, but we don't have that same level of celebrity for science and engineering professionals, when in fact they have a more important role in our daily lives than do the entertainers or the athletes.
More from Lockheed Martin CTO Ray Johnson is a minute away. This is Planetary Radio.
Bill Nye the Science Guy here. The next Mars rover, Curiosity, is about to land on Mars. You can join the celebration. PlanetFest 2012 is Saturday and Sunday, August 4th and 5th at the Pasadena Center in California. I'll be there with dozens of special guests, spacecraft displays, a space art show, great activities for kids, Planetary Radio Live, and the landing on Sunday night. Kids 8 and under are free. You can learn more at planetfest.org. It's a PlanetFest. I'll see you there.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. I first met Lockheed Martin Chief Technology Officer Ray Johnson when he visited the Planetary Society booth at April's USA Science and Engineering Festival. Now he has joined us on Planetary Radio to talk about why his company is using that festival and other efforts to get more young people interested in STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And they're not just talking to students.
Well, one of the attendees at the festival that I had a chance to speak with for some time was Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education. And Arne went around and saw all the exhibits. He actually brought his wife and his kids there. And, you know, there's nobody who has a bigger interest in STEM education than does Arne, and in fact, than I think does the administration. Raising that level of awareness, it's really a cultural issue as much as anything else in the United States. I think we need to bring about a cultural change, if you will, in what we celebrate. And so the educators are doing their part. I think they're growing more science and math skill teachers. That's an important component to have the teachers who actually teach the subjects have backgrounds and training in the subjects themselves. But I think more and more, we certainly, there were roughly 1 million people who attended the festival in the mall 18 months ago, and more than 500,000 people came through the convention center, and the families, the kids, the looks on their faces, and the excitement that they expressed tells me that there is a love and a desire to learn more about science, technology, engineering, and math, And the educators, I think, get that. I think the administration gets that. And certainly Arne Duncan's comments and support to us showed that.
Yeah. Did you get the same sense of tremendous optimism being in that crowd of people, that half million at the convention center, that this, you know, there are a lot of people in this country who do believe in science and engineering?
Absolutely. The thing that struck me, the two things that struck me the most about the crowd was, number one, what a wonderful, diverse group that we got to come to the convention center. People of all race, creed, and color, of age, of experience. And then the second thing is the enthusiasm that they all showed. And it was really contagious. You saw the entertainers on the floor who maybe were telling stories about science or demonstrating science experiments. The crowds were standing room only around the excitement that was associated with what they were showing.
With just a couple of minutes left, I want to give you a chance to talk about the things that Lockheed Martin is up to that you're most excited about right now. And can we start with what I would have to say was the centerpiece of your huge exhibit at the USA Science and Engineering Festival? That was a space capsule named Orion.
Yes, the first Orion spacecraft for NASA's Exploration Flight Test 1 is undergoing the final welds at the Michoud Assembly Facility in New Orleans, even as we speak. This spacecraft will be delivered to Kennedy Space Center this month. And there it'll go through final assembly and integration, leading to a 2014 test flight, which will launch Orion 3,600 miles above the Earth in this critical test flight and reentry, testing reentry for deep space missions. So the Orion team is now in production operations at Kennedy Space Center, and they're working on harness fabrication and getting ready for that, working in the Launch Control Center, which was just brought online. So it's a very exciting post-shuttle environment, and it's becoming real right before our very eyes.
Remind us of why this is not your father's Apollo capsule. This is something quite new.
It is quite new. It is the capsule, and so it's going to, when people see it, I think it will remind them of the Apollo capsules because it's not shuttle-like. But it's going to have capabilities and enhancements around safety, around fundamental capabilities that will be far and above what the Apollo astronauts went through during that program.
Is it your hope that this capsule is going to be the one that finally, after all these decades, gets humankind out there beyond the orbit of the moon?
It certainly will provide that capability for the government and for the nation when we decide to move forward on that path.
Anything else that you want to call our attention to? I was intrigued by your mention of nanotechnologies, nanostructures, carbon fiber.
Nanotechnology is a component of advanced materials, which is going through a dramatic change. I think for the first time in probably 20 or 30 years, two or three decades, we have an opportunity to blend some of the advanced chemistry work that's going on with advanced materials, and we're beginning to see payoff in the area of nanotechnology as an example. Metamaterials is another example. And when you combine advanced materials work like nanotechnology, some of the composite work with advanced manufacturing, you begin to see a revolution in manufacturing that can be very exciting for the nation and move what we know we've lost in terms of cheap labor-based manufacturing into a whole new realm of manufacturing that could be a job creation engine for the nation and certainly a wealth creation engine for the nation. So we're very excited about it.
Ray, I better let you go. I've kept you a long time. Thank you so much for this second conversation about the exciting things that Lockheed Martin is up to, and especially for the company and your leadership in getting more young people to go into these areas that are going to keep the United States competitive and keep all of humanity pushing out there in the final frontier.
Matt, thank you so much for offering me the opportunity to speak with your audience.
It's a great pleasure. Ray Johnson is, as we've heard, the Chief Technology Officer. He's also an Executive Vice President at Lockheed Martin, the world's largest aerospace contractor. Lockheed Martin is the founding sponsor of the USA Science and Engineering Festival. The second time around in Washington took place just about a month and a half ago. Planetary Society was there, but our booth was kind of dwarfed by the presence of Lockheed Martin. The centerpiece there was the Orion capsule, soon to be, we all hope, headed up beyond Earth's atmosphere. We'll head up there as well for a look at the night sky with Bruce Betts in just a few moments here. That'll be for What's Up.
sitting in Bruce Betts' office, right across from Bruce Betts. So it's time for What's Up. Any significance to the fact that we both are wearing shorts today?
Yes, the significance is you chose to wear shorts today.
Because you wear them a lot. I just thought, I just want to, you know, emulate you.
Well, that makes sense. That happens a lot in my life.
I'm not ready to tell people what's up in the night sky yet, though, so you do that.
Okay, I do want to say I've just enjoyed a fabulous anti-gravity mint from the collection you got me last week at JPL. I appreciate that. I feel lighter already.
They're strangely uplifting.
Speaking of uplifting, up in the night sky, in the evening sky, we've got Mars to the right of Saturn. All of that going on in the southwest in the evening. Saturn will be hanging out near bluish Spica for quite some time to come. And over the coming weeks, Mars reddish will get closer to Saturn and Spica. It's all very exciting. In the pre-dawn, things are a party with the super bright Jupiter and super, super bright Venus low in the east. Very low in the east, but they're getting farther apart. Jupiter's getting higher. Interestingly, you'll have the moon in the mix on July 15th, making for a crazy bunch of bright objects over there in the east in the pre-dawn. And earlier on July 9th, Venus is very close. It's close all the time right now to Aldebaran, the brightest star in Taurus. But they'll be quite close on July 9th, so check that out. We move on to this week in space history. It was this week 15 years ago. Mars Pathfinder landed on Mars.
That is so long ago. How can that be?
I have no idea. I have no idea. It doesn't seem that long ago. Seems a lot longer ago to my children, though.
Yeah.
Something about not existing at the time it happened makes things seem older.
I was going to say we have listeners to this show who weren't alive at that point, which is very depressing.
Well, I'm glad they're listening to our show. A little more recently, but still an amazingly long time ago, the amazing Mars rover Opportunity launched in 2003, 9 years ago. Still working on the surface of Mars.
Still trucking.
We move on to Random Space Fact.
And I was going to do a celebrity one this week, but I guess we'll hold off. I have a celebrity Random Space Fact, but we'll do it next week.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm very excited. I can hardly wait. I don't even know. I don't know who it is. It's so exciting. But in the meantime, the orbital speed of the solar system. That's us. As we go around, not the sun, but our whole solar system as it goes around the center of the galaxy is about 220 kilometers per second. At that speed, it takes us about 1,400 years to travel a distance of one light year. But it takes only 8 days for us to travel 1 AU, the distance from the Earth to the sun. That would be our whole solar system and our movement around the galaxy.
It's really fast. It's much faster than we've ever sent a spacecraft anyplace. And yet it's so incredibly slow.
It is, because things are so incredibly big. Big. We move on to the trivia contest. And I had asked you, what is the brightest star in Ursa Major, which of course is what contains the Big Dipper, and what does its traditional name mean? And as I'm sure you found out, Matt, I was just so amused I had to ask that part.
And now we're all amused, or those of you who aren't yet will be in a moment. Our winner, Brian Sevilla, I believe a first-time winner from Rockville, Maryland, he was one of those who discovered that the name, which is pronounced, is it Alioth?
I believe so.
Okay, so Alioth means the fat tail of a sheep.
Yeah, how can this be true? It's supposedly from Arabic, so perhaps some Arabic speakers out there can tell us if this is really true or just some myth that's built up. It seems odd you would have only one word to describe the fat tail of a sheep.
And I wondered the exact same thing that Kurt Lewis did, which is, why in the world is there a star that means fat tail of a sheep in a constellation that has to do with a bear? Now, Kurt's theory is that maybe the tail is hanging out of the bear's mouth.
I would have just guessed it was different cultural things, but that's probably it. Let's go with that.
Well, we're going to send Brian a Planetary Radio t-shirt, and then it's next week. Of course, it'll be too late for anybody to get in on this when they hear this, but it's next week we're giving away the Celestron Telescope. But I do have a cool prize for the question you're about to ask.
Cool. All right, back to our going around the galaxy. Approximately how many times has the sun gone around the galactic center since it began nuclear fusion? And it's going to have to be approximate, because the amount, the galactic year is a little soft in terms of it's not one a specific number, it's a range right now. But still, get us the approximate number of times since the sun was born, by which I mean, you know, started nuclear fusion, how many times has it gone around the galactic center?
That is so dramatic. I love it.
Ooh, how exciting.
All right. You have until the 9th of July, that'd be Monday, July 9 at 2 p.m. Pacific time, to get us that answer. And here is the prize. We've never given one of these away before. A classic, a Fisher Space Pen engraved, either Planetary Radio or Planetary Society. I'm not sure. But it's your own Fisher Space Pen. You can take it up into orbit with you.
Wow. That is a classic. It writes in any direction. You can write upside down with your Fisher Space Pen.
I even heard you can write underwater, but then maybe all pens do. I don't know.
Yeah. Isn't it, it's engraved?
Yes, we're going to have it engraved as well.
Wow. We're cool. All right, everybody. Go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about a block of cheese. And I'm going to go back to my snack.
Oh, I can't bear to watch this. He has an actual block of Tillamook cheese, and he's about to take a bite. Now, I love cheese as much as the next guy, but he's Bruce Betts, the director of projects for the Planetary Society, and he joins us every week here for What's Up.
Mmm, that's good cheddar.
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, Kenneth Brower, son of the late environmental hero David Brower, talks with us about his father's legacy. We'll also speak with Fran Hunt about the Sierra Club's My Piece of America campaign and get some green cuisine tips from Chef Annie Somerville from Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. The late David Brower is widely regarded as one of the great environmental leaders and heroes of his generation. He was the first executive director of the Sierra Club in 1952 and also went on to found many other environmental organizations, including the Earth Island Institute, the League of Conservation Voters, and Friends of the Earth. This year marks the 100th anniversary of his birth, and in honor of the centennial, his son Kenneth Brower has compiled a book called The Wilderness Within, Remembering David Brower. He joins us to talk about it today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about what made you decide to write The Wilderness Within.
This year is my father's centennial. He would have been 100, and we are having this centennial celebration, and sort of a year-long celebration with an exhibit and this book and a speaker series. And the book was just, it just seemed a good time for the book. So that's why I did it.
And what was your process like for writing this book? Who did you speak with to really begin to develop this this picture of your father?
I just began to contact local people mostly who had a story, who had crossed paths with him and had a story to tell about him. And it was really first come, first serve. I realized at the end of the book I could have done 100 of these interviews. And maybe I will someday, there are 19 in this book, and it really just scratches the surface of the people he influenced and who influenced him.
Now, who are some of the people that you talked with in the book who really felt like your father had a profound influence on their lives?
There were people like Paul Ehrlich, who begins the book. My father and the Sierra Club were co-publishers of the Population Bomb, the epical book in the conservation argument. Hal Gilliam, who was a great reporter and still is for the at 93, I think, for the Chronicle, who's really covered the environmental beat for the Chronicle for 40, 50 years, was awfully good about what he had to say. Dave Pessinen, who sort of led the fight to stop a reactor at Bodega Head, was influenced. And David Phillips, who's now one of the executive directors of the Earth Island Institute, was told a very nice story about how my father sort of evangelized him into this movement.
Now, there are hundreds and I'm sure probably thousands of people who would say that they were influenced by your father. But as his son, you obviously have a very unique perspective. What do you feel that you learned from your father that helped to inspire you in your own environmental leadership?
You know, my first memories and my first lessons in this regard were at Sierra Club High trips. And my very first memory is when I'm very small in the Sierra with my mother and father on one of these trips. What he did for his kids was really two things. He introduced us to the wilderness of the Sierra Nevada and the rest of the West, the Southwest and the Cascades and the Olympic Peninsula. And I think that's what almost any parent who brings his kid to the wilderness does. All you have to do is lead him down the trail, and the natural world does the rest. So my father did that part. And then the other thing he did was the idea of wilderness, the idea of the importance of these wild places was sort of was a lesson that we got taught along with it. So we got a sort of a crash course in all the great thinkers in this area, Thoreau and Emerson and Leopold. And so we had the idea of wilderness taught to us at the same time. And I think for all of us, that was formative. We've all, in one way or another, been sort of drafted into this movement.
What are some of your favorite specific memories of your father?
I do remember in the mountains just following him down the trail. He was a great climber, one of the great ones in his period. And one of the interviews in this book is with Steve Roper, who's sort of the California climbing historian. And he refreshed me on my father's climbing accomplishments. But it was many first ascents in Yosemite and elsewhere in the Sierra. So I just remember trying to keep up with him on the trail. He was a multiple peak guy, and he had a terrific cardio, and he was able to really, even into his 40s, just leave us all behind. That's one memory. I suppose working with him, I worked with him at the Sierra Club doing Sierra Club books for the first part of my career. It was what he drafted me into, doing these large format, exhibit format books. And I just remember working with him. He was a man full of energy, and he loved it when he pulled all-nighters in the cause all the time. He loved it when somebody else was pulling them with him, and he always liked it when I spent a night up with him trying to finish the work on a book or something like that. I never met anybody who had more energy. I mean, he was just he had a tremendous physical energy. One of my questions always is. Which came first? Was it the cause? Was it this passion for the movement, or was it just the physical energy that allowed the passion for the movement? And I don't know. It's a chicken and egg thing, and probably can't tease it apart. But it was. But he definitely was consumed by this cause.
And what do you think it was that motivated him to do this work? I mean, did he have a eureka moment where he realized it was his life's path? I mean, where did the fire in his belly come from?
I think it was in the Sierra Club and in the Sierra Nevada. I think it was where he discovered himself. He went as a climber and then expanded that. I mean, he didn't just see the granite under his hands. He saw the whole range and its beauty. He was an aesthetician. He loved beauty, and he especially loved the beauty of wild places. So I think, a decade spent as a sort of a climbing bum in the Sierra exposed him to this beauty, and he felt it was important to save it. And he went from there. Just the sort of I think his locomotive, his sort of core motivation was saving wilderness, but it expanded. He was very good at seeing all the things that sort of folded into the environmental movement, how much scope the movement really had, and it involved pollution and water quality and air quality and nuclear proliferation and weapons. All these things have an environmental component. They're all things that affect life on Earth. And he was one of the first to insist on the scope and the breadth of what this movement should be.
What do you think most people would be surprised to learn about your father?
That's a good one. I was surprised myself to learn that he counted steps in the mountains. It's a silly little thing, but it was a surprise to me because it was a little OCD, I guess, and it just for me did not jibe with the imaginative component. He was so creative a thinker I can't imagine dreaming up some of the things he dreamed up while I'm counting steps in the mountains, but that's the way he seems to have worked. Nothing else really, nothing, I don't know what would have surprised people. I think they would have been surprised by the intensity of the dedication. I've never met anybody who so threw himself into what he was doing, into the cause that he believed in.
What do you think your father would say about the environmental movement today?
Well, I do know what he did say, and he thought the movement was getting too bureaucratized, and he even felt this about the Sierra Club. He came back after his troubles with the Sierra Club, after he was kicked out as executive director, after his 17 years there, he would get dispirited sometime by the amount of process that a board meeting or that the Sierra Club has to go through, as opposed to action. And he really, he understood the almost inevitability of it. As an organization gets big, it has to develop a bureaucracy, and it has to develop managers. And the Sierra Club, when he was first executive director, was just 7,000 members. He was only the second full-time employee. The first was Virginia Ferguson, the secretary. So it's one of the little lessons for me in this book is how this movement has grown. Just 50, now 60 years ago, there were two staff at the Sierra Club, and now it's an enormous nationwide organization. So some of this has just come with growth, and it's inevitable, and it's come with the necessity to fundraise. But there is a different movement now, and it does. What my father would wish is for Sierra Club and all the other big outfits would be to somehow diminish the amount of process and institutional inertia that always develops in these outfits and keep the fire in the belly thing going. And, of course, the club succeeds in a lot of that, but it could always do it better, I think.
Some people credit your father with also having invented new forms of using different media to tell stories about our cause that would motivate people. So, for example, you mentioned books. I mean, people credit your father with basically inventing the idea of the coffee table book. Isn't that right?
He did. He and Ansel Adams and Nancy Newhall, in the very first exhibit format book, which was called This is the American Earth, really did invent a genre. There were big art books that would crush coffee tables back then that a few rich people could own, but there wasn't this book of, you know, large format book of nature photographs with argument in it. It was a new genre. And he did. You know, he became the executive director of the club in 1952 and immediately jumped into a fight against dams on the Colorado, especially in Dinosaur National Monument. And he and the club and their coalition were really the first citizen group ever to stop a big government project in the United States. And they did it, and my father sort of orchestrated it in this sort of prototypic environmental campaign where he did a book with Wallace Stegner, enlisted Wallace Stegner to put a text together on Dinosaur and what was important there. He did a film, the Sierra Club Bulletin, which he was then the editor of. He did magazine articles. He organized river trips of Sierra Club members to go down these canyons so that these canyons would have a constituency, so that they would have a bunch of people who cared, who loved the place and cared about it enough to write congressmen and make a fuss. And that's what happened. There was strong grassroots organizing. There was publishing. There was editorials. There's op-ed pieces in sort of the campaign that we now are pretty familiar with. And it was successful. They succeeded in stopping two dams that would have flooded Dinosaur National Monument.
What advice do you think your father would have for environmental activists today, and particularly for young people?
He used to have a standard advice to young people who would come to him at the Sierra Club or at Friends of the Earth when he was leading those outfits. And they would say, please, I heard your speech last night. Please sign me up. I want to work for you. And he would say, you know, there's a very limited number of spots in environmental organizations. So there's not, I can't hire you in the Sierra Club, or I can't hire you at Friends of the Earth. But what you need to do is you need to go back to whatever you were doing. You need, if you're a law student or if you're an economics student, you have to go back and be the best kind of green environmental lawyer that you can be, or you've got to you've got to use your legal abilities on the side to do that. Same in economics. Or if you're in business, you've got to somehow mainstream these environmental ideas, this environmental ethic in business. And he would point out that, you know, that's what drives our society is not environmental organizations or nonprofits, it's business. And he would often say, unless and until we mainstream these ideas in the greater world, in the business world, we're not going to make it. So you have to go back to these places, and you have to carry the message there.
Anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
Just that this book was a lot of fun for me to do. It was a chance to hang out with my father again 12 years after his death, and in a way that only a writer really can. I got to really think about him in a disciplined way because I was putting together the introductions to these interviews, and I was listening to the people who talked. And the nice thing about this form of interviewing 20 different people was that each one has a slightly different angle on my father. So the result is a kind of a multifaceted portrait of him, because everybody, you know, there's a lot of convergences and similarities, but everybody had a slightly different take. So it made for a very full portrait of him, I thought, of almost like you'd get in a novel with multiple narrators. It was a many-sided view, and I really enjoyed putting it together.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Ken Brower, the son of the late David Brower, and author of a new book called The Wilderness Within. Joining us now is Fran Hunt from the Sierra Club's Resilient Habitats campaign. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Fran, your team just launched something called the My Piece of America campaign. Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, it's something we are really excited about because it provides an online hub to engage not only club members but the public to recognize, to share, and to help protect America's great and most treasured outdoor places.
What does that actually look like? How are we helping people to recognize and protect them?
Well, you know, we're actually doing something that no one else is doing. The site is really one of a kind because, like a number of other sites, it does let folks post their pictures and their stories and their passion for the places that they really love near and far to them. But it does something else. It gives people a real opportunity to translate the passion that they have into action and to connect to Sierra Club chapters and staff and allies who are actively working to defend our nation's great outdoor lands. So it's not just a wonderful opportunity for people to share the places they love and tell others about them, but it's a real opportunity for folks to engage and take action. And that is why I'm so excited about it.
What are some of the places that people have picked so far as their favorite places?
Well, you know, they are really widely varying, as you might expect. They range from Central Park, which is, of course, so important to folks who live in and around New York City or even folks who visit. Also the Florida's Gulf Coast, Yellowstone, and beyond. And folks are posting their pictures. They're telling us about the time they have spent in these great places with family and friends. They're talking about the fun and adventures they've had, hiking or boating or backpacking. One photo I really liked was taken by a fellow who had visited Yellowstone. He took this great picture of a grizzly bear. And, you know, that is just such an iconic species, and he knew and really appreciated what a great landscape Yellowstone was. And it really, you could tell by the way he wrote about it, that really he was just delighted to see such a wonderful animal, and he was just so happy to be in a place so grand as Yellowstone.
Now, your campaign is working to protect certain places as new national monuments. Tell us a little bit more about that, and what are some of those places?
Yes, we are, and we have a number of them that folks can learn more about on the My Piece of America website and take action to protect. Let me talk about a couple of them. One is the Grand Canyon Watershed in Arizona, and that is adjacent to Grand Canyon National Park, which is one of my favorite national parks and a place that I took a rafting trip that was a real trip of a lifetime for me. So it's a real special place for me personally. But the Grand Canyon Watershed would help protect the Kaibab Plateau, and that has some of the Southwest's largest unprotected old-growth forest. It's home to some really interesting and diverse species, including the Kaibab squirrel, Which lives nowhere else. So it's really an amazing and wonderful place. But like too many of our nation's wild places, it is very much threatened. It's threatened by ill-conceived uranium mining. It's threatened by irresponsible off-road vehicle use. There's a lot of pressure to log those wonderful ancient forests, which are on national forests. And there's, unfortunately, too much livestock grazing going on. So by declaring this area around the national park a national monument, the president can really help protect it from these threats and make sure that it is maintained for future generations to enjoy and for others like me to have a trip of a lifetime, either down the river or hiking the canyons and the forest. And it's a place that we think is so special. And fortunately, we have a president who can take action and safeguard it for us.
What are some of the other places?
Well, another one in the great state of Utah, another state that's really special to me, is Greater Canyonlands. A lot of folks know Utah for its red rocks and its canyonlands. They're really some of the most amazing lands in the nation. Folks come not only from all over America, but internationally to visit them. It's special to me because I've spent a number of years of my own career fighting for wilderness protection for Utah, and I'm a biologist, so the fact that the Greater Canyonlands has so many is really a biological hotspot. It's got 27 wonderful species of wildlife that are sensitive and needing protection, everything from mountain lions to desert bighorn sheep and bears. But it's not just a place for wildlife. It's a great place for people to recreate and enjoy and explore. A lot of hiking, mountain biking, backpacking, rafting opportunities. And one more thing that I think is so special, it's one of those places that is very, very dark at night. And so you get the beautiful, brilliant night skies full of stars. And for anybody who has never, for anyone who's ever experienced that, that really is a joy and something that's getting harder and harder to come by. And again, the president could take action and protect Greater Canyonlands as a national monument and ensure that those wildlife species and those great recreational opportunities continue for future generations.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Where should our listeners go for more information about the My Piece of America campaign?
Well, listeners can go to sierraclub.org, and they'll be able to find a link.
Well, thanks so much. You've been listening to Fran Hunt from the Sierra Club's Resilient Habitats campaign. Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
For those of you who tune in every week, you know by now that Annie joins us and talks with us about different vegetables and fruits, produce, what's in season, and what you can cook with it. Now, we thought it would be a good time today, Annie, to talk about how people can make their own vegetable stock at home, which is also greener because then you don't have to buy it in a can or a carton and you can save the waste of the extra packaging. So how can people go about making vegetable stock simply at home to use in some of these cooking recipes?
Well, I'm a big advocate of making stocks because we at Greens, we are producing so many vegetable scraps every moment of the day. And also, I find that the packaged stocks can be salty. And so I'm a big advocate of just bringing out the flavor of the vegetables in the stock and not having salt be an overriding flavor. So I would say there are a few rules for stock making. And other than that, it's quite simple. But rule number one is be sure to use vegetables that are reasonably fresh. You don't want to use it as your you don't want to take anything and put it in your stock that should be going into your compost or your worm bin.
I'm probably guilty of doing that. Maybe that's why my stock isn't turning out so well.
There's some flexibility there. So you be your own best judge there. And then the other is, unless you're making a broccoli soup or a cauliflower soup or a cabbage soup, I recommend staying away from the members of the brassicas family because they can be very overpowering. But if you
For our listeners who don't know the terminology, the brassica family is
broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, all those yummy vegetables that are pretty, pretty strong. So, and can be overpowering. For instance, if you were making like a delicate brothy soup, you wouldn't want to use them. And then what else? I think it's good to just, you know, have kind of ratio, just a rough ratio would be to use maybe for if you want your yield to be about 2 quarts of stock. And I will also say if you're going to make stock, go ahead and make a double batch and use half of it right away or in the next day or two and put the other half in the freezer. And then that way, the next time you're feeling like making soup but feeling like you just can't quite get it together, don't do the whole thing and just pull the stock out of the freezer.
Okay, so going back to how you actually make the stock,
mm-hmm.
you take a whole bunch of vegetables.
Yes, and so I would say a couple of onions. If you happen to have a leek, the leek tops are great. A few cloves of garlic. You don't have to peel them. You can just smash them with the side of your knife, leave the skins on. Maybe a couple of carrots. A potato or two, you can just scrub them. You don't need to peel them. Cut those into big chunks. What else?
Maybe some
mushrooms.
Celery.
Yes, celery, definitely. And celery, maybe a few stalks, but not too much because that can be a little overpowering. And then you can kind of take it from there. For instance, if you're making a squash soup, then you can use the skin and the seeds from squash. Or if you're making a broccoli soup, include some of those broccoli trimmings. So I also add sprigs of fresh herbs, if they're available, a couple of bay leaves. So in this case, like here we are in sunny California, I would add some thyme sprigs, some parsley, some sage leaves, maybe some marjoram oregano, some salt to draw. Salt helps to not only draw out flavor, but also it's a chemical process. It begins to break down the vegetables, so they release their kind of breaks down the cell walls of the vegetables. And then a few peppercorns, and then cover that maybe with 10 cups of water, and then put it in a big, well, put that whole deal in a big pot, and then bring it to a boil, lower it to a simmer, and maybe cook it for about 45 minutes, not much longer, because really at that point in time, you've gotten everything you can out of the vegetables. And then pour it through a strainer or a colander, and then just press it with whatever utensil you like to press with, just to get a lot of the juice out of the vegetables. Set it aside to cool, and there you have it.
And put the vegetable scraps in your compost.
Put those vegetable scraps in the compost. And I can also say, if you want a more browner, a more golden stock, you can start by sautéing your onions and garlic in a little bit of olive oil or a canola oil, something you like to cook with. And that will kind of give it a deeper, richer flavor. But it's really not necessary, so it's up to you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Phil in University Place, Washington asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, what is the correct temperature for my refrigerator and freezer? I want to make sure I'm not wasting energy."
Well, Phil, the best thing to do is to set the fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and the freezer at zero. And because it takes more energy to keep a freezer cold if it's empty, make sure to keep it filled. If necessary, you can use jugs of water or ice. Standing there with the door open, pondering what to eat, is an indisputable juice drain, so keep that door closed. If you want to get even better energy savings, visit EnergyStar.gov to find Energy Star appliances. These are more efficient models that will save energy and save you money on your bills. So remember, set that fridge between 35 and 38 degrees Fahrenheit and set the freezer at zero. And for the best energy savings, look for an efficient Energy Star model.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at sierraclubradio.org. This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Hello, I'm Michael Intiman.
I'm Michael Abel.
And we host a show called Noise Pollution, where we play jam, metal,
Indian blues. It's every Wednesday from 8 p.m. to 10. You should tune in.
You really should.
It's a good time.
It really is.
It's lively.
It's entertaining.
Pleasant.
Copacetic.
It has merrymaking jocularity.
There's one word I'm looking for in particular.
Antics?
No.
Tomfoolery?
No.
Frolicsomeness?
What?
What?
It describes what the show has. They're cheeky and fun.
You mean shenanigans?
That's it.
That's Noise Pollution, every Wednesday from 8 to 10.
on the only station that's making waves,
WHFR.
Cats and Kittens, dig the hottest and the coolest music around on Swing Time every Monday afternoon, 2 p.m. till 4. The big bands, the small groups, and new swing music. Hear it all on Swing Time, Monday, 2 till 4, the only swing on this radio thing.
Jim Jab Jump is a solid jive.
Makes you 9 foot tall when you're 4 foot five.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
WHFR, Dearborn. Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your girl, Miss Lady, and you are tuned into Divine Inspiration. That's right, right here on WHFR, your station that's making waves. You know, I've got a lot of things going on, a lot of music to share with you, and a lot of details to give you about just different things that's going on in and around the city. So you know you got to stay tuned with your girl and kick it with me for the next 2 hours right here on this station. That's right, it's 89.3, and I'm going to kick it off with a little bit of Jordan Armstrong, Where You Are.